very genuine fervor and imagination, ended up by inviting so much more repression and creating many more trouble for the people on whose behalf they went to struggle. All that is true and all that is possible and all that has to be guarded against. But I still think a few mistakes, or even many mistakes, should not be understood to mean let's keep our hands off, because then...
It's the question of the intellectuals who will discuss.
Is the
I think it's an important question.
What we discuss is when people are able to do things that need to be done, how they were able to do, or when they make mistakes, to share their mistakes with others. But in abstract, I don't know how one can discuss the role of intellectuals. And that's the problem of intellectuals. They're always wanting to discuss in abstraction. Let's discuss in concrete why under some circumstances people are able to help, and why under certain other circumstances they are not able to help or are able to create more problems than they went to solve. And in that sense, yes, Manushi does discuss a great deal of concrete situations under which these two things can happen, or a mixture of these two things can happen.
I just wanted to say that it seems to me that all the problems that you're discussing about the so-called disadvantaged sections of society are basically a function of poverty. Are basically a function of poverty.
No, let me hear you through.
Yeah.
And I'll try.
And I just feel that the solution to that lies not so much as, you know, as saying changes in attitude or things like that, but more so in really, you know, developing in material terms and developing those sections.
The answer is both yes and no, because I think I have to divide my answer in three parts. Number one, today if you look at poverty in India, one specific thing that we have to keep in mind is it's not a situation of absolute poverty. India today has absolutely no need to have even one hungry person, right? So it's to do with power relations. It's to do with who controls how much and why. So then poverty alleviation programs cannot work unless you're really dealing with power relations and change in power relations and control structures. And examining also the way governmental structures will reinforce some of the existing power relations. Number two, even I think it's very, here the example of women is very pertinent. If you look at women's oppression, then we have to acknowledge that it cuts across many sections, many economic and other strata, right? And women, for instance, in a rich peasant household or an upper middle class household in an urban situation could be even more powerless under many circumstances than a woman landless laborer, simply because at least this woman has the right to fend for herself, no more. But a woman, for instance, in a peasant household may or may not be allowed to even step out. With whom she talks, walks, how much, is all determined really by very oppressive norms. And even if the family might own substantial amounts of land, the woman does not have the right to own land or the right to manage land. And I think the question of then women's land rights, women's property rights, and putting them into operation becomes very important. So there too, the fact that within a very well-off opulent setup also you can have a set of people who are so powerless is to do with then maintaining of certain power relations and the need to alter those power relations.
That's right, but I mean, when you talk about solving a problem, it's more try and see where it's concentrated. Because, you know, at least I think so, I don't know if my assumption is correct, but probably it has to do a lot with the material well-being of the family as such. You know, whether there is oppression. No, I agree with what
no,
you said.
No, in fact, it doesn't work like that, you know. If you look at sex ratio figures, and there was very interesting study, for instance, done in West Bengal, two village studies, one where which was a land reforms village, and another village which was a village where land reforms had not been carried out. which is to say, in the land reform village, there was the percentage of landless poor was small. There were more families, peasant ownership was the general pattern. And in the village which where land reforms had not fully been carried out, the percentage of landless poor was much larger. This study was published in Economic and Political Weekly. I can give you the reference if you care to look at it. Now, here what's found, and many other studies have confirmed this pattern, I think. What was found in these two villages that, for instance, the survival rate of baby girls in the in the village which had not carried on in land reforms, and therefore there were many more landless poor who were poorer. People overall were eating less well fed, but male female disparity in consumption patterns, even in children, was not so wide. So baby girls had a better chance of survival. In the other village, where there was relatively more food in the family, the male-female disparity in consumption patterns is wide. So female mortality rate among in this group was higher. And I think that is, when you look at various infanticidal groups in India, then it's not the poorest who are as infanticide, who have a history of infanticide as much as the better off sections, for instance, in human society.
No, I just meant it as a broad generalization. But I think, of course, you know, there is, I guess the problem has to be attacked in other ways too. But one very important thing is that, you know, India is basically a poor country. I mean, not poor in terms of, I understand what you mean by the distribution aspect, but still, I mean,
it's a mismanaged country. To call it a poor country makes, you know,
okay.
No, it's not really so. It has almost everything that should make any country well off. All the human resources and the natural resources. It's great amount of mismanagement and a great deal of, you know, sitting on people's heads and not letting them even fend for themselves.
Let me rephrase it. I'm just saying that those sections of society which are poor, they should develop positivity.
If you mean we should pay more attention to the survival needs of poorer sections, I'm in total agreement.
Yeah. So
priority should be given.
So what I'm trying to say basically is that, I mean, there's nothing like, you know, having this much of energies to devote to this and that question. But if you can put it that way, that, you know, as far as trying to solve these problems goes, I think more energies should be devoted to the material question rather than change of attitude.
Okay, I agree with that. Just adding one more, you know, to tell you why the battle becomes so much more unequal. In the last few years, you find, for instance, many attempts all over the country to tackle this problem. And there have been attempts throughout history, but a certain acceleration. Now, at the same time, you don't see the kind of results that one would expect from it. And I think one important reason for it is that if the poor in a particular area, you know, are to just struggle vis-a-vis those that employ them, or let's say the landless poor are involved in a struggle against the rich peasants demanding minimum wages, very simple demand. As soon as any attempts to organize in order to collectively strengthen your demand take place, there is what you find happening is that even though most of these struggles might be to do with asking the implementation of government's own laws, the government machinery, the police and the administration will come and invariably enter this conflict on behalf of the rural elite and unleash repression so that what would otherwise have been solved with less pain and less bloodshed gets to be much more unequal battle. So that even struggle against poverty in that sense, you know, and struggle for real allocation of resources for this, that and the other gets to be so much more complicated because of the bloody role that machinery tends to play.
Right. Now,
could we go to some other questions,
please?
Yeah. Somebody here. Somebody needs to be monitor. Otherwise, I.
You said that the change of the political system
specify what you mean by changing the political system. If you're talking of change in system, then systems don't change with the change in governments. The task of changing systems, I mean, you can have a particular party which professes certain goals come into power. It could be power by a mass movement or power as a coup. You know, you could even have a coup. Okay? Now, which does not necessarily mean, I mean, when, say, the Bolsheviks came into power in 1917, it could be described as a revolution or a coup or anything what you like, but the task of restructuring society began after. And we know that what you profess as aims and what governments profess as their aims and what they actually end up doing are not necessarily in conformity with each other. So I would not go so much by the label that a particular government carries on its forehead. I would go by its actual doings. That's one. Secondly, I think today, if you ask me, what I'm really asking for much more than which label of government to choose is, let us try to limit the harm-doing ability of the government. It has unlimited ability to do violence. It's the greatest violator of all its laws. It's the greatest violator of human rights, and most governments tend to do that to lesser or greater extent, you know. So the question really is, how do you tie the hands and feet of the government in a way that their harm-doing ability is limited? And once people are left little bit alone to sort out things without somebody coming and beating them down, that's one. And secondly, what I would put on the agenda along with this is decentralization of power. No matter under what label it came, unless, I mean, what we've built after independence is this very brutal, very authoritarian, centralized system of governance. So that everything just emanates from above and there's, no responsiveness, absolutely. The machinery does not have to be accountable to anybody for anything. And making machinery at the local levels, starting decentralization of power, beginning at the village level, greater community control over institutions of government, the local police station, the block development officer, whatever, control over resources, and beginning really at that level. Without this, I don't think change of government at the top, or whatever label it may carry, is going to happen.
In the same connection, I've been looking at the status of women in Pakistan and Bangladesh, is it of any interest to you?
Yes, greatly.
Are they better off?
In most ways, no. No. In fact, one thing in which Pakistan, I think, on the whole, is doing economically better than India. And I think there's less hunger and starvation in Pakistan, not so in Bangladesh. That's
problem.
One. No, so that will affect women and their health. And women are the ones to eat last and the least. So where there is overall hunger and starvation, women are likely to be victims of it. In any famine, for instance, the number of female deaths are much larger than that of male deaths. So in that sense, but I think what in India is better off than most third world countries in one respect, which is with all the problems we have, we've still not had to deal with military dictatorships and total repression of dissent. I think the tradition of dissent and space allowed for its social political dissent is relatively being large. And so in some many important ways, things are better.
Okay. In the academic profession, a woman who is working in academy, does she suffer from sex discrimination? Do you get issues like that in the Manushri magazine?
See, there is discrimination world over. Okay, that's one. So one can only talk of relative, on relative scales. I think in professions, especially top level professions, in India, women are likely to face less discrimination than here. There is less open contempt. There is less resistance to women in high places and positions of power. There is, we never had this problem with equal wage for equal work kind of thing right from the beginning. But only for professional women. A woman construction laborer, of course, will get far less wages, no matter what the law says. So at that level, top professions, I think women do relatively better. But again, a lot depends on where's the starting point. Did they get the support they needed for being educated? Are they allowed to enter a profession by their family or not? Once that's taken care of, relatively less discrimination. But which is not to say there is not. I mean, this, a characteristic example would be nurses versus doctors, you know, the way nurses are likely to be treated. Even in private school establishments, for instance, where there is private management, women teachers might be very badly treated, even harassed sexually. But the higher you go, the better it is for women in India. Because if you reach them.
You said one of the main purposes of Manushi was to give out information about the rights of women. Now, the audience of Manushi is restricted to that or from college and above. Don't you think, in order to affect this problem, you should have something at a school level? Because I know, I myself, it was only when I went to college that I sort of knew I could do something about it. At school level, I was never really confronted with the issue, and it was restricted to that, as you said, the dowry rape kind of thing, in order to sort of broaden it. Have you, does Manushi or any other organization that it works with, has it talked, does it spread information among schools, especially among the 14 and 15-year-olds, because...
Not enough has been done on that front, not just by Manushi, but I think by and large, women's groups and women's organizations have not had yet the energy to go into that. Though with some schools we have good relation. I mean, you know, it's happened spontaneously, automatically. Say one school teacher gets to be Manushi subscriber, then she's going to use it in her classroom. That, in that sense, it's happening a lot. And we do get occasionally even gifts of stationery from various schoolgirls and all that. But I think Manushi's readership, it would be not correct to say that it's confined to college-going types of people. Even though you're right, those who can read English or Hindi are likely to have been educated. But one way in which Manushi has gone beyond this urban educated group is reaching a large number of social and political activists all over the country, many of whom working in rural areas, many working in urban areas with poor. And Manushi tends to be used as a tool of organizing the great deep. In Hindi-speaking regions, you will find a lot of groups using it as a reading material, even in adult literacy classes, or for raising discussion on specific issues. In other areas, which are non-Hindi-speaking areas, there are a lot of regional translations done of special articles of Manushi, which are relevant for that area, and using that again as stimulant for discussion, raising issues in the organization, and much else. So it does reach, in one sense, a much wider audience than just the educated through these indirect channels.
I was quite interested in your historical perspective of women's rights in our country, particularly looked at how Gandhi, during the freedom struggle, how Gandhi treated women. And I think you concluded by saying that the position of women was much better during the freedom struggle than after independence. And, you know, all throughout you were trying to say that, you know, that there's relatively more freedom in our country, and that if you look at the centralized authoritarian structure that we have in our country, it's become more and more repressive. And as more and more organizations are formed and more people go out to the country, I mean, the government, restrictions of the government is imposing this considerably increase in the last 1 to 2 years. There's been so much more restrictions on what volunteer organizations can do and, you know, what would the government means by public interest and so on.
What I said about the national movement, just a clarification, what I said was not necessarily that women's situation was better, but I do think that a greater legitimacy came to be given to women's issues in the national movement. There was a very more receptive atmosphere. But I think there were several other limitations that the movement suffered from, which is many of the leading women activists that came into the national movement, at least those who became leading figures, political figures, tended to be wives or sisters or daughters of powerful movement leaders, you know. Very few women came and stood on their own.
Even today
it's like that. And that does leave a certain kind of a legacy. However, I still think that the movement created very receptive ground for women's issues, and there are many important things done during that phase. You write about this repression, and I think not only putting restrictions on voluntary groups, which the government is constantly trying to throttle them wherever they are engaged in struggles, engaged in brutal repression where struggles are, but increasingly what you also find the government machinery involved in is just leading massacres. I mean, all of what you call anti-Muslim riots, Hindu-Muslim riots, or even anti-Sikh riots in November 84. If you examine each one of these, what you really find is that there has been blatant use of the governmental machinery to unleash a massacre, and the police will actively either participate, lead, or at least assist when these massacres are being conducted. And particularly the Muslims, I would say, are facing almost a situation of systematic genocide. It may sound like a strong word, but I think it needs to be used. And so, whether it's dowry murders, in fact, it would be interesting to examine the role of the government machinery. If there is dowry murder, that's bad enough, that somebody should so brutally murder their wife or daughter-in-law or whatever. But look at the role of the police and the government machinery. They will convert it into a suicide if you bribe the police. And routinely, hundreds and hundreds of dowry murders are being passed off as suicides, and the courts will carry on the same attitude throughout. Very few, not even 1% conviction rate you find if you examine the outcome of most of these dowry murder or wife murder cases. Or if there is, for instance, look at the role of the police when it comes to gang rape here and some atrocity there, constantly engaged in, the state seems to be engaged in conducting a war against its own people. Localized wars, so you don't see them on a large scale. Picking targets here, picking targets there. And almost nowhere do you see ever the machinery being brought to account. We don't even have an inquiry commission report yet on who conducted the massacre, in November 84, or Bhiwandi.
But the laws have been changed, so then
they need not even be presented. Yeah. You're right. It took 1 year to get an inquiry commission established, and then they went about it with this funny way whereby the victims were put on trial, and then the ordinance came that the reports may never be made public. And there'll be more. And there has been very serious curtailment of fundamental rights, civil liberties, by way of enactment of various laws. Maintenance of Internal Security Act, we know what MISA did during the emergency. After that, there has been National Security Act, Disturbed Areas Act, now there's Anti-Terrorist Act, what have you. And all it means is complete suspension of basic human rights anytime, anywhere the government chooses to do so. Very arbitrary abuse of power, and with very little recourse available.
Question about that?
What do you think about the
Indian
government hashtag? Do you see that as changing the lives of people and people who are sending life back to work for lower class women? And in what ways?
In rural areas, we know. I don't know about high tech, but at whatever level technology has come in, especially in what are known as the green revolution areas, what you do find is an increasing marginalization of women from their traditional occupations, while not being able to gain entry into newer occupations. I mean, like, say, grinding of corn, on where as long as it was done on a grinding stone, or husking of rice was hand pounding of rice, then millions of women earned their livelihoods through these marginal professions. But as soon as, say, a flour mill is set up, which is not high tech, but enough to displace women, then the person operating the machine will always be a man. And it's been true for many, many other occupations. Even in the industry, you do find, whether you look at the coal mining industry, cotton textile, jute textile, there has been a marginalization of women in all these occupations. There are some industries, like, you know, the electronics industry and garment industry and so on, few industries where women have gained new entries. In the government, there is, you know, good number of women employed in the government machinery, banks and offices and all that. But in by and large, technology in rural areas especially, but some also in industrial centers, has marginalized women. Yes. And women, I mean, India tends to have a very high proportion of women doctors. Part of it could also be because women are hesitant to go visit male doctors. So a certain amount of it, and then, you know, maybe one blessing of seclusion is you have to have that many women professionals dealing with. But in medicine, I think there are fewer taboos against women's entry. And even when they've gone into other fields other than gynecology or obstetrics or whatever, they haven't done badly.
But they mostly tend to specialize in gynecology.
That's true. Or general physician, children's, pediatricians. Yeah. You will also find very few women at the top levels of administration of the medical system. Director of All India Medical Institute may or may, I mean, seldom will be a woman. But that's not, yeah.
To get back to his question a little bit more, what do you see the role of Manushi, or, you know, yourself as an academic, or however you'd like to describe yourself, I don't know, in a situation where there is so much political repression, where there is so much ethnic polarization, like Hindu Muslims, Sikh Hindus today? I remember reading your article in Manushi about how you visited Sant Longava, and, you know, you were very optimistic then that if more people could do things like that, it suddenly, you know, people wouldn't have all these ridiculous stereotypes about the others. And besides writing about it and publishing, what else do you see yourself as, you know, not going into the streets carrying placards and doing
demonstrations? No, we do it all the time.
Yeah. Okay.
I would describe myself more as an activist rather than an
academic. Okay.
No, that's just, we do it all of that. I mean, like, when
so
all these legislations came, we were out on the streets protesting. We had been, I mean, beginning with, say, the Sikh issue, you know, our first involvement was with riot relief. And out of that experience, the report on the massacre was published. After which, we were involved with various groups who were demanding an inquiry into who massacred. So it's at many levels, it's more active involvement than just writing.
What about at present? Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing in the present, say, about the Punjab issue?
By and large, despairing. But I don't stop even while I'm despairing. See, even while I've been here, I have been invited to many, many meetings by the Sikh community. I've addressed many meetings in Gurdwaras, also many Sikh organizations, the few that I hear. And it essentially happened because many of them had read Manushi's coverage of what we were doing, what we wrote. And when they got to know somebody from Manushi was coming here, they arranged for dialogue. And right now, what I would be interested in doing is, one of the things that I've tried through this trip, and I've talked to hundreds and hundreds of people to many cities of America, is to say, to begin by saying, firstly, this tremendous divide that has come to be. People are not even talking to each other. Even old friends have stopped communicating, right? this big schism that has come between the two communities? How do you begin by bridging that? And secondly, I think what's important is to involve Sikh community in a broad-based human rights coalition, which is happening, for instance, in India. There are organizations of the Sikhs who are not just, you know, talking about it as a Punjab issue, but as a human rights issue, dealing with it as an issue of regional autonomy, decentralization of power, you know, and so on. And to we work together with such groups at various levels.
Does that affect your credibility within the Hindu community? I mean, has the name calling, for example, has there been name calling, or have you gone beyond the stage that you identified as, say, you're pro-terrorist or something because, you know, you talked to a Sikh today, you know, that kind of thing? Because
has it affected my credibility with you?
No, but no. I'm not from India.
You're not from India.
I work with a similar group in Sri Lanka. We are trying to bridge the gap between the Sinhalese and the Tamils. And certainly, I mean, the name calling, you know, goes on all the time. You must be pro-terrorist if you dare, you know, even raise the issue that Tamils have certain rights and things like that.
I think what might have helped is that it is fortunate that Manushi came into existence much before the Sikh crisis. So there was a certain expectation that people had from it. You know, they don't expect us to say Pitam. I mean, that's not the kind of voice that they would ever hear in Manushi. So at one level we have, and since we keep very close contact with people who read Manushi, distribute Manushi, this, that, and the other, I think at one level I would say, of course, there have been responses, angry responses. There have been some bit of name calling and all that, the rest of it too. But also a lot of people being very concerned and saying, are you on a suicide mission? Do you want to live or die? Why are you risking Manushi? You will invite trouble so much sooner if you do this. And especially when I came here, I was being very actively dissuaded, for instance, from visiting Gurdwaras when I was invited, and warning from saying they will kill you to saying you will never be able to enter India after you've done that, and you will go straight to Tihar jail, not to Manushi. All that, but I did find that even here, and as in India, our persistence has helped get at least a few people who are definitely a minority involved enough to say we should try and do something about it. And so that while there is name calling, but there is some support base too, and we're not dismissed so lightly, let's put it that way. Name calling, yes, I mean, but I would be more concerned if people thought you were mad, or, you know, they're lunatics, but it's not, that's not what's happening.
Oh.
Yes?
What are your hopes for Manushi as an organization? Is it big enough? Do you need more money? Do you want to decentralize and have other offices? Where do you want Manushi to be in a couple of years?
You know, Manushi takes me. I don't know whether I'm taking Manushi in there. It's really taken such unplanned courses that it's very difficult to say where we would be 2 years ago. 3 years ago, somebody told me you'd be involved with the Sikh issue. I'd say you are mad. Tumhare baga bas gaye, aisa bolte. But today we are really deeply involved with that issue. Now, I can't predict that. But however, we do have some specific agendas. We would, for instance, like, apart from the magazine, it's possible we do a few other things, such as explore filmmaking as a medium to deal with some of these issues. Street theater we've already been doing for a while. Maybe publications also, a series of books or booklets on serious issues with more in-depth investigations. So working out solutions to problems, not just exposures, and with some depth involved. So hopefully some guide to action. None of this may materialize, I don't know. But this, also, I think it's quite likely that we get more involved with some more deeply involved in minority rights issues, especially I would say Muslim minorities issues, because I do see very bad things happening on a very regular basis. And today I think what's needed is really a human rights commission which investigates into the overall situation. And I don't see the government being able to do it, or even if it undertakes it, to be able to do justice to it. And I think what I would like to see ourselves doing is being part of that effort to create that kind of large-scale investigation to show what's actually happening. Because right now the stereotypes prevail so heavily that people are not even willing to acknowledge it as an issue. And what not, I don't know. More and more.
In connection with this, do you see religion as playing a negative part, in, especially with respect to women?
Okay. See, I'll start off with a general statement. I think most religions, during most times of history, have been justifying injustice to women. There is very few religions who can today say we have done justice to women. However, I also see within each religious tradition, important dissent traditions within each religion. Within Islam, for instance, Sufism came as an important dissent tradition, which did break through some of the boundaries that religion created for people in general, women. Within Hinduism, I see the Bhakti movement and many other such movements as very important events for women, which did try to break women from certain kind of shackles. And would be true for Christianity and every religion, I think. But overall, religious and religious institutions, I think, have played a very anti-women role. However, having said that, if one were to analyze today's situation in India or globally, I would say it's not religion today which is the sword that's killing. The ideology which is being used to sanctify the large-scale massacres or small-scale massacres which are going on all over the world is nationalism. And therefore, I see nationalism often using religion as the biggest deadly force. Even here, you know, if you have to go in America, has to go and run amok in Latin America, it will say national security, national interest, wave the national flag and just go and run amok anywhere. India, we can't run amok globally. We run amok on our own population. So we wave the national flag and say national unity, which means war against minorities, essentially. So today when I hear the word national security or national unity, what I see is war against some or the other targeted group, internationally or locally. And it's religion being used by nationalism, but in and of itself, I don't think religion could be such a deadly force. I mean, Zia cannot be a Zia without being a military dictator. You know, it's Islam can't produce a Zia by itself. And even today, we cannot have the kind of massacres we are having against Muslims just on the basis of Hinduism. Because how will you unite people on Hinduism? Somebody would say, but I'm South Indian. Another one would say, but I'm, you know, North Indian. I'm a Shivite and I'm Lingayat. And God knows all that, which is just as well. I'm glad there are so many diversities, because a united people are a deadly lot, I tell you. They just can run amok. And so, it's when you say you need to massacre in Nagaland in the name of national unity, national security, then everybody will clap and then suspend all its moral judgments. Any kind of brutality can be so easily sanctified, justified, and everything else when nationalism comes waving the flag.